Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome Matt Wolfe, who is the London correspondent of Variety and International Herald Tribune, who's kindly agreed to do the third of a series of four on looking at what's going on in cities around the world and talking about New York. The format we're going to have is Matt's going to talk for a bit about a number of sort of issues, and then we're going to open it up to the floor. I hope you'll join in. And we'll then sort of come to a close. And if you want to pursue particular lines of argument or want to carry on and have a drink, don't feel you have to rush off. Just to explain what's happening at the back is a lot of... we get an extraordinary use of the building by school groups, get sort of about 25,000 school children. And America is a very hot topic in schools at the moment for all sorts of reasons. And so we're taping tonight, and I hope you'll feel free to join in and you'll be down for posterity. But I guess I wanted to start off by saying the election's over.
Yes, yes.
Mr. Bush is in the White House for 4 years.
Sadly true.
What does that mean for American theatre?
Not a lot of very good things. I suppose it means a little less in New York potentially than it would elsewhere, because New York obviously was a state, and New York City a city very particularly, that didn't vote for Bush. But on the other hand, everything is interconnected. And in a climate where arts funding was already fairly parlous, and of course government subsidy basically doesn't exist, and you're thrown back on corporate philanthropy and individual donors and that sort of thing, it seems particularly grim. That's just getting the stuff up on its feet. Then I guess there's the ancillary question about what sort of work is getting up on its feet. And that's in a sense the more vexed issue, because you know, funding is one thing, but that shouldn't affect what the artists are doing. But there does seem to be a worry now that there's going to be a sort of implicit, and I stress implicit, kind of self-censorship going on, i.e. people aren't going to tackle subjects because they feel that perhaps there's no way for them to be seen or heard, or if they are thinking in any way on a large scale, there isn't the context in which those plays or shows can be produced. There are all sorts of ways in which this is borne out. I mean, very interesting, just today, the Public Theater off-Broadway, which was one of the great sort of maverick theaters in the U.S., a theater where I did a lot of, you know, theater going when I was, you know, growing up and saw many, many wonderful things. And it was run by the late Joe Papp, who was sort of a legendary firebrand and somebody who kind of embodied the all that was best about the New York sort of cultural sensibility. He died some time ago, but then he was replaced, actually, two people on from another maverick director named George C. Wolfe, a fascinating black American talent who has decided, for various reasons, to step down at age 50. So his successor was just announced today, and he's a director called Oscar Eustace, who works at the Trinity Repertory Theater in Providence, Rhode Island, and he's, you know, a talented director. He was very active, among other things, in spearheading Angels in America, Tony Kushner's play, in its very, very first embryonic form when it was done out on the West Coast, long before it ever came here to the National Theater. But he isn't, I think the feeling is that he isn't quite the sort of aggressor that Joe Papp was and that George Wolfe was, and maybe this is emblematic of a time in which there really isn't room for aggressors in quite that way. I mean, there's been a lot of talk in Britain about all the political theater that happens here. You know, I mean, David Harris' stuff happens, obviously, and some of those, like the Menace of George W., even Tim Robinson's play Embedded coming here to the Riverside for a rather longer run than it might have had at a different time. And it hasn't been lost on anyone that, you know, these plays are all happening here. They're not really happening there. There's a good off-Broadway venue called the New York Theater Workshop, which does a lot of Carol Churchill. In fact, right now they're doing her play A Number with Sam Shepard. And they had been talking about doing Stuff Happens. But, of course, the problem is one has to do with sensibility. Now, that is probably one of the few theaters in New York where that wouldn't be any problem whatsoever, because the audience for that would expect a play like that. But then you come down on the other issue of cost. And that is problematic when, you know, you've got a play that has a cast of 22. And, you know, here at the National Theatre, as part of the £10 season, which that play was, you can do it for a budget of £75,000. But there's just no way you can do a play with a cast of 22 for the American equivalent of that. It's impossible.
I suppose the other immediate question is, obviously, it's 3 years on from 9/11, and how, looking from this side of the Atlantic, you feel that that's influenced what's happened in New York over the next over the last couple of years, and how you feel it's shaping it up for the next few years.
Well, one of the things about 9/11 that was interesting, I think, for the New York theater was that it sort of it kind of threw down the gauntlet for New York theater goers to sort of tether their affections to the fact that New York had an art form which was unique to New York. The thing about, of course, being interested in movies or books or music or whatever, television, obviously, is that it's the same all across the country. You know, the same movies open in New York and L.A. and in, you know, they open in the blue states and the red states simultaneously. But New York theater is unique to the blue state that is New York. So I think one of the things that happened as a result of 9/11 was that New Yorkers were made to feel in a rather particular way very sort of proud of the fact that, you know, New York theater was uniquely theirs, and because tourism to the city for that period, I mean, obviously it's since picked up, but tourism then was very much down. There was a great sort of civic drive to get New Yorkers to go to the theater, and New Yorkers kind of embraced that challenge, and there were, you know, at that time there was the Broadway revival of Kiss Me, Kate was on, and that was a show that was going to close, and there was a whole thing about, you know, the New York community mustn't let this fine production close. And in fact, it did get a reprieve of several months. Of course, there's a larger issue, which again has to do with the work. And I suppose, you know, Broadway is a commercial marketplace, and it has always been that. And so I don't know that things are perhaps as risky or as dangerous as they might have been before 9/11. Although, having said that, there are always exceptions. I mean, it was rather extraordinary this past year that the Tony Award for Best Musical went to a rather small, politically subversive puppet musical called Avenue Q, which is something from, first of all, from off-Broadway, which is where it originated, and even within off-Broadway, way out in left field. And it's a tiny show. I mean, it sort of began in a theater rather similar to the Donmar before moving to Broadway, and it was up against these big leviathans like Wicked, which was, you know, a $14 million production with a cast of thousands. So it was extraordinary that Avenue Q, particularly with its political subversiveness, did have this impact. So it would be unfair to sort of say that there are no risks going on and there aren't sort of shades of gray to the cultural landscape. But I do think, I'm just always aware, I remember some time ago going to New York on vacation, and there was a, walking around 44th and 45th Streets, which are the main hubs of the Broadway community, every theater that didn't have a show on would have something up on the marquee that said, "See a Broadway show just for the fun of it." And I thought that was very evocative of what Broadway is aiming at. But of course, there are Broadway and off-Broadway, which we'll talk about.
I mean, before leaving 9/11, people may be aware of this. In the proposals for the rebuilding of the site, they've made a decision to include a theatre in there, and quite an unusual theatre by New York standards. Do you think that's an appropriate thing to do on a site like that? I mean, it's obviously some distance away from the main theatre district.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the question about whether it's an appropriate thing to do in a site like that is sort of a larger question about whether you think there should be something built there at all. And that's sort of a separate issue, because there are people who feel that the ground itself should be consecrated and hallowed, and nothing should be erected there, and it should just be allowed to be a sort of shrine to the, you know, victims of that tragedy. On the other hand, if you feel that there should be some sort of building, I absolutely think that theater should be part of it, because, you know, if you believe that theater is a sort of civic gesture, I mean, it does bring people together in a way that you wouldn't have otherwise. And there are, in fact, lots of cultural organizations in that part of Manhattan. There's a very interesting theater called The Flea, F-L-E-A, run by Sigourney Weaver, the actress's husband, Jim Simpson, which is not far from Ground Zero. And in the years since 9/11, that theater in particular has been quite sort of at the forefront of plays or multimedia pieces that relate to what happened. I mean, they did a play that came to the Edinburgh Festival in this country called The Guys, which was subsequently filmed. So I think, you know, it would be quite good to have a theater in that vicinity, just to remind people that culture in New York is decentralized, as it is in London. It isn't just about, you know, a few streets in and around Times Square.
Okay, I mean, moving on a bit, I wondered if you could almost give kind of, you know, the state of the nation or the state of, you know, theatre in New York as you see it overall. I mean, do you think it's on the up, on the down? Do you think, you know, how do you feel You know, what's your view of the overall scene?
Well, it's going through an odd period right at the moment. The Broadway season, I mean, here we are, it's the middle of November, almost American Thanksgiving, which is next Thursday, a week from today. And it's really taken the season an incredibly long time to kick into gear. I mean, by contrast, you know, this September in London was the busiest theatrical September that I can remember in the 21 years I've been here. So I think there's a feeling that things are slightly lethargic there. Things are now happening, but even within that, it's odd. There's been much talk about the plethora of one-person shows at the moment. On Broadway, any play with a cast of two constitutes an epic. And I think right now, well, let's see, we just had Whoopi Goldberg opening. Dame Edna is about to open. There's a Mario Cantone, who's an American performer. There was a play called I'm My Own Wife. There have been something like six or seven one-person shows all within the last 6 months, but five of them are happening right at the moment. And this is largely a function of economics, because it costs an extraordinary amount of money really to do anything on Broadway for union reasons, for you know, which are paradoxically, I mean, people always think, because Britain has such a tradition of union domination, that the unions would be stricter here. But when it comes to theater, they're much more sort of tough-minded there, and it's much harder to kind of get around them. So even, you know, for Dame Edna, who was on Broadway not that long ago, to have his, her show at the Music Box Theater, I'm sure is costing, you know, the better part of $1.5 million. But and then there are a lot of revivals as well, and that's fine, because you always want revivals as part of the landscape. And in fact, it's going to be interesting in the new year, because there will be revivals of, you know, three of the greatest of all American plays within several weeks of each other. Kathleen Turner is doing His Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Jessica Lange is doing The Glass Menagerie, and Natasha Richardson is doing Streetcar Named Desire. So it's fairly unusual within such a short period of time to see, you know, three landmark American plays. But of course, what you always want is the new stuff, because, you know, that's where the theater, you know, gets pushed forward. And I think the feeling there is that Broadway is kind of a lost cause, unless it's stuff that has come from London. London, of course, is very popular as a seedbed. Tonight, in fact, is the Broadway opening of Democracy, Michael Frayn's play. So London is good off-Broadway or regional theater, but even then it has to be a certain kind of play. So a lot of playwrights who, perhaps in a different climate or a different environment, might be working on Broadway are working very happily and fruitfully off-Broadway. I mean, Woody Allen has a new play that is in preview off-Broadway. Neil LaBute, who's had many plays done here, has a play that's off-Broadway. So, you know, I think, again, it's all part of this decentralizing process.
That was something I wanted to ask you about. I was in New York a few months ago, and as some of the people know here, we're wrestling with what to do with our studio theatre here, because one of the extraordinary things in central London is how few fringe venues there are. There's virtually none. And I was just astounded by the growth in recent years of not only off-Broadway venues, but off-Broadway, particularly on Theatre Row, which is the extension of 42nd Street. I think there's something like 18 sort of 100 to sort of 300, 350 seat houses. If any of you haven't been to New York recently, these are being funded by planning gain, largely, by building condominiums over the top of them. So in exchange for sort of selling the air rights, they're building theatres on the ground floor. And they're functional, I think one could say. They're a bit like going into a multiplex cinema, but there's this huge growth in new spaces. And I was just astonished by the number, because I think in London there's about sort of 20 off-Broadway venues, and I think in New York there's at least 40 now, possibly 50.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. There's been a lot of talk about this, because, you know, it's as if you have all these wonderful showcases but no shows. there's exactly what you talked about on Theatre Row, which certainly, you know, when I was growing up in Manhattan, my parents were very involved with one of the theaters on Theatre Row, Clarice Horizons, and that now is just part of this extraordinary sort of explosion of theaters, some of which are exactly in multiplexes. I mean, there's one where I saw Neil LaBute's play, The Mercy Seat, which later came here to the Alameda, where you walk into a general foyer and there's something like five or six theaters. And just like going to, you know, the Odeon Mezzanine in Leicester Square, you have to pick the right one or you end up seeing the wrong show. But But there are others. There's a sort of worldwide plaza at the corner of 8th Avenue and 50th Street, which is one of these sort of high-rise complexes. And there was a multiplex movie theater in the basement, but that's all now been redeveloped. I haven't actually seen it since it opened, because it only opened about a month or so ago. But that's going to be, again, a sort of multiplex. And they have something like five or six different venues for, you know, smaller works. I guess one of the things about all of these is that they're smallish theaters on the order, I guess, of the Donmar, the Almedo. They're actually probably quite a bit smaller than either of those, because the Donmar seats 250, and I'm sure most of these don't seat, as you say, much more than 100 or 150. And you just hope that, you know, New York has actually never really had a problem with auditoria. The problem has been what to put in them. I mean, you know, the Public Theater, which I was talking about at the beginning, which is an amazing, amazing building down in Lower Manhattan on Lafayette Street. It's extraordinary, you know, kind of geographical site. And they have five different venues under one roof. But I don't think there's ever been a time where all five of the venues were operating concurrently. And that would be unimaginable from a London standpoint. I mean, you know, you can't envision going to the National and having Nick Heitner say, well, two of our three theaters don't have anything tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, it's funny you say it, because when I went in there, I was trying to pack everything in, and I had to leave a play halfway through to get a plane. And I came out, and the fascinating thing was this, you know, the attendant said to me, oh, you didn't like that play. Do you want to go and sit in another one? which I thought, that'd be great if they did that at the National Theatre.
Yeah.
But it kind
of... That's great, I love
that. It was slightly the... I don't know what the phrase is, the kind of cinema, you know, it was an interesting sort of experience. So you're basically saying that the problem really is there's not enough good new writing.
Well, I don't know if there's not enough good new writing. There might just not be enough good new producing in order to find a financial model whereby a play in a venue that small makes any sort of financial sense. Because one of the things that's happened is, as Broadway has got more and more expensive, and for instance, I mean, here's a for instance, Martin McDonagh's, I think, extraordinary play, The Pillow Man, which recently won the Olivier for Best Play, is going to Broadway in the spring with Billy Crudup in a production opening in April, and it's supposedly going to cost $2.1 million. Now, this is a play essentially with a cast of four, so if it's costing $2.1 million to do a play with a cast of four, what has happened is that all the stuff that might have been on Broadway, say now or even 5 years ago, is going off Broadway, but then the prices on off Broadway are inflated. Mm. So you see it kind of extends exponentially down the line. So where does it end? I mean, I suppose where it ends logically is you have a series of workshops, because then they have their own funding scenario, but then those aren't open to the press, and you know they're not ticketed in the same way. So in an odd way, off Broadway now is sort of what off Broadway used to be. Mm. And off Broadway is very much what Broadway used to be.
Yeah.
And then Broadway is this kind of showcase for glitzy revivals and you know, the occasional sort of surprise hit.
Yeah. I'm sure there'll be some questions about sort of the classic Broadway in a few minutes, but do you think everybody's always sort of predicting the sort of death of it, and you know, it seems to stagger on. And in fact, when I was over there, it seemed to be kind of sort of very, very, on a sort of day-to-day basis. You know, this extraordinary energy and the crowd and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see any sort of longer-term trends in there? Because I've been always hearing in the West End that, you know, same sort of thing, that, you know, it's in crisis, and yet, you know, another year goes by and everybody's still around.
Well, you know, as the wonderful Barbara Cook said, who just turned 77, the theater is always dying and it's always being reborn.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's because New York tends to do everything rather more dramatically than anywhere else. It's probably particularly true in New York. Yeah. But I think, you know, to sound the death knell of Broadway is absurd, or the death knell of the New York theater, because there are just too many people who depend for their livelihood on a sort of pulsing theater economy. And, you know, the fact is these buildings are listed buildings. Mm. Nothing can happen to them. You couldn't tear them down and you know, build a McDonald's instead.
Mm.
So they have to showcase something. Mm. Now, several of them actually have been turned into places of worship. The Mark Hellinger Theater, where many years ago I saw Mickey Rooney and Sugar Babies, is now, I think, a home for visiting evangelicals. Mm. So maybe we'll have, you know, 40 versions of that. But I don't think so. I think there's still enough of an appetite, and there are enough people who depend on that. And you know, the fact is, artists are always going to continue to work. The only thing that might change is where their work gets seen. But every so often you have something that sort of restores your faith. I mean, the most extraordinary thing to me the early part of this past season was an amazing musical by Tony Kushner and Jeanine Tesori called Carolina Change, which was really fantastic and politically very fiery and very moving and musically very sophisticated. And this premiered at the Public Theater, then transferred to Broadway. It didn't make money commercially, but people didn't really think it would. They just wanted it to be seen before a wider audience. It's just opened a run in Los Angeles where it's doing very well. Mm. So, you know, if people have the work, there will be a way for it to find an audience.
The other thing, I mean, one of the other things that intrigued me was, I don't know if you've been, I went to the Zipper Theatre.
It's
in a zipper factory, hence the name. It's on 37th, 39th Street. But it's extraordinary that so close to Broadway, like five streets away, there are derelict, not semi-derelict buildings that you can take over and turn into theatres. And you don't get this sort of appalling feeling, I think, that you get in the West End, that there's this core and there's no way that you can expand because of the, you know, land values and everything else. And I was amazed. I mean, what was the most extraordinary thing was the production was put on by the cast of Chicago, who finished, and an hour later were putting on...
Oh, was this the B.B. Newworth, Kurt Vile
piece? That's right. And, you know, it was... to me, it was one of the most fantastic things to actually be able to go and see the cast of Chicago doing a small-scale production in a very intimate theatre, sort of half an hour, hour after they've been, you know, performing a full-blast musical. And it's the sort of dynamic between Broadway and off-Broadway, which simply really doesn't exist in the West End.
I also think of that as a very New York thing, in a way. The fact that, you know, when you finished your Broadway show at 10:30, the evening somehow isn't over.
Yeah.
You know, you have your other show that you do at 11:15, and then after that, who knows what you do then, you know, because you're not racing for the last tube. I mean, that is a very kind of New York dynamic. But there are all these extraordinary venues that people aren't necessarily aware of. There's one on, I think it's West 54th Street, where Urinetown, the musical, first began, and it's just next to this big sort of police station, and it doesn't feel like any kind of conventional theater venue. So I think that's, and actually there's another interesting venue under the Brooklyn Bridge as you're going from Manhattan, because of course New York is five boroughs, so as you're going from Manhattan across to Brooklyn, and there's this whole arts complex underneath the Brooklyn Bridge, which has the rather odd acronym of Dumbo, as in the elephant, and it's Simon McBurney, who, you know, is a British theater director, has done a lot of work there, tends to get kind of the avant-garde visiting stuff and also homegrown stuff. The Worcester Group has done a lot of work there. So again, you know, it certainly, if any of you are planning to go to New York, it rewards seeing what else is there besides just the 40-odd theaters that make up the Broadway spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Which I suppose brings me on to the question, leaving aside the cost of the flight, if you could spend a week in the West End or in London watching theatre, or a week in New York, and you had to recommend choice to the audience, which one would you go to at the moment?
What, in London and New York?
No. Oh. If you had a choice to say, go to New York for a week or go to London for a week, I mean, how do you see the two things sort of comparing at the moment?
Oh, it's so hard to go. I mean, the thing is, obviously, you know, I love London. I love London theatre. I wouldn't live here because, you know, nobody forced me to live here. So I think there's a great breadth and diversity available here that you don't necessarily have in New York. I mean, as somebody who read English at university, it's very nice here, for instance, to get a constant array of the classics, and not just Glass Menagerie and Streetcar Named Desire, wonderful though those are, but to get, you know, the European classics. And this year in London, there's been a steady array of terrific productions of the Greek plays, and that's been great, not to mention, obviously, Shakespeare and the British repertoire. So I think in New York, you'd have to slightly adjust your horizons. Having said that, as anyone will know who's ever seen a hit show on Broadway, whether a play or particularly a musical, just because it's more obvious with a musical, there really is nothing like seeing a Broadway hit show when it has just opened or when it's in the sort of first flush of success. I remember some years back there was a musical at the Imperial Theatre called Jerome Robbins Broadway, which was a kind of compilation of the best of the legendary director-choreographer Jerry Robbins, and it got one of these sort of ecstatic love letters from Frank Rich in the New York Times, and as a result, the next day, it was a December morning, I seem to remember, the next day, that was the only thing that everyone in New York was talking about. Now, oddly, London had a little bit of this just recently with the producers, and it's something that I don't associate much with London, and it's interesting that it seemed to happen in London with a Broadway musical transplant. So, I think, you know, you... of course, anyone can have a wonderful time going to New York and going to the theater, but don't go looking for, you know, Shakespeare and the Greek plays.
Yeah,
go
yeah.
looking for something else.
Yeah. Can I just ask a question? I mean, how many people here go over to New York, you know, at all? Well, yeah, so you're all fans. I think just to bring the first bit sort of to a close. If you had to pick, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 sort of young talent across the whole spectrum of theatre that you in New York, you know, the sort of things, people that you'd be sort of tipping for the future, are there particular people that you feel, you know, if you could sort of push them up the ladder of success, you'd like to more you know?
That's a good question. Well, I don't know that some of them really need pushing up the ladder. They seem to be pretty far up to begin with. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm very interested in Adam Gettle, who's a young American composer who's actually the grandson of Richard Rodgers. Mm-hmm. And he has a show which everyone seems to think is going to be his breakthrough show called The Light in the Piazza, which is opening at Lincoln Center, I think, in April or May. And this is a show that has been extensively talked about. I mean, one of the things that seems to be happening now with the next generation, certainly in musical theater talents, is that, you know, they're very well known to a certain dedicated coterie, but it's a very, very small group. Mm. So the question becomes, how do they then burst beyond those parameters and actually reach a mainstream public? And I guess Adam Gettle doing this show at Lincoln Center will be his leg up. The musical has already been seen, I think, in Chicago and I believe Seattle. And people were very high on it in both those cities. So I would be very optimistic about that. There's a very interesting young playwright. I'm not sure he's even 30. Chris Shin, who's had quite a few plays here at the Royal Court and actually at the Soho Theater, but he is also doing other work that hasn't necessarily always been seen here in New York at various theaters like the Vineyard or Playwrights Horizons. There's a wonderful Black American woman writer named Lynn Nottage who wrote a play last year, which probably got the best reviews of anything on or off Broadway. This was an off-Broadway play called Intimate Apparel, and it was very, very good. It was then seen on the West Coast. She then had a sort of rather extraordinary sequel to it in a way, or follow-on from it called Fabulation, and that did quite well. So she seems to be, I mean, that's one nice thing too in New York with so many emerging artists, and not just emerging, but, you know, artists who've already arrived, is the sort of racial and ethnic and cultural diversity really across, you know, across the board. So,
because it's quite interesting, because it's, I think, still a very big issue, isn't it? In fact, Theatre Voice did a talk about it recently about, you know, waiting, you know, is there a real breakthrough in London in terms of having a city that's having, you know, people now from all over the world, and you feel that New York's achieving that at the moment, do you?
Well, in terms of, I don't think there's any sort of political or sexual or social or ethnic persuasion in the New York theater that would feel disenfranchised. Mm. I would feel surprised if they did. Whereas here, you know, for a variety of reasons, there are, you know, you hear Black British artists feeling that they can't get their plays seen in the mainstream or whatever. I mean, you know, the most eagerly awaited play on Broadway this season, which typically, I guess, for New York at the moment was derailed because of a funding crisis. Mm-hmm. This is the new August Wilson play called The Gem of the Ocean, mm-hmm. which was supposed to have actually already opened by now, but it was a $2 million-plus production, and just at the last minute, $1 million of the $2 million-plus dollars fell out. Mm-hmm. So they had two choices. They could either have aborted the production altogether or sent out a kind of siren song for backers, and they got this extraordinary woman, Carol Sharnstein Hayes, who's a theater producer based in San Francisco, to stump up the missing million. Mm-hmm. So now it will start previews on the 23rd of November and open on December 6th. But I mean, August Wilson, who, you know, by now has had 10 or 11 plays on Broadway, doesn't really need much introduction, but the sort of British equivalent of a Black writer like him doesn't really seem to have emerged here. Although, you know, people like Kwame Kwayama are getting shows done repeatedly at the National. Mm. But I suppose that's one good thing about New York.